Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Professor's Inn podcast. I am Kel Weinhold, and I am the productivity coach for the Professor's Inn.
And I am Dr. Karen Kelski, the founder of the Professor's Inn and the person behind the social media outrage machine.
Well, to be fair, you also work on job documents.
Yeah, right.
Tenure
help
documents.
Help edit your job documents and your tenure and promotion documents.
And your grant applications
and
your books.
And help you negotiate your academic and academic adjacent job offers.
Well, I don't know. You're going to have to. Will you be the force behind the rage machine now that the one of the sources of much of the rage is not, at least there's not a
right.
visible manifestation for yeah. us to constantly react.
I know. I don't know. Honestly, this is recorded the day after the inauguration, and I'm still trying to figure out where in my body this. How this is going to get in, mm-hmm. how this new reality is going to sink in, because it sort of is there and it's not there. It's in and it's not in. I haven't assimilated it. I don't know what to do with my time. My mother, who's 93, texted me today. I'm going to have a lot of time on my hands now that I'm not monitoring. She said about herself, I'm going to have a lot of time on my hands now. That I'm not monitoring everything that idiot does. I think that's what she said.
Well, and I talked to clients today in the group productivity sessions about reclaiming just working, mm-hmm. not working and monitoring. And just to be clear, you know, this is acknowledging that there is a lot of work to do, and we are in deep trouble as a nation, and we have such a steep climb out of the mess that was created, and we have the same steep climb out of the things that existed. And Trump was a manifestation of. So
right.
I know that.
So the problems of white supremacy and the pandemic are not gone on right. January 21st.
Right. And we also don't have to wake up in the morning with an existential dread about what actual threat mm-hmm. is coming today. Mm-hmm. And one of the people on the call yesterday during the inauguration or after it was from the UK. And I said, well, Americans, you know, I'm wishing you just a little less stress when you wake up in the morning. This person said, what we'd really like is no big news from you guys for a while. It's just like the whole world feels the same way. Just no big news. I know you got a lot of shit going on, but just no big news. Mm-hmm. So I think I just wanted to acknowledge for everyone that trying to figure out how to recover from that kind of stress.
Sustained
stress.
I mean, it's so many people who are my friends and in my circle and on the Facebook page talk about it as an abusive relationship, and you get out of it, and that doesn't mean that it's years long. It's right. basically right. 5 years if you count the campaign.
Right.
And so, it's a lot. And I think that this is tangentially related to what we're talking about today, which is, well...
Abusive advisors.
Yeah.
And it's not tangentially, because this came up in my mind because I thought we were talking about sort of the long-term effects. And I thought, oh, this is like the long-term effects I see on academics who have been in unhealthy relationships with their advisors.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually directly related.
Still, for me, in my mind, it was uh-huh. directly related. It's like, Karen, let's talk about abusive advisors, was because of my realizing, oh, maybe the patterns that we're going to see in ourselves as we try to recover from this, and feeling the gaslighting in particular, is going to be very similar to what I see for people who had really bad advisors.
Well, let's step back, because the academy as a whole is abusive.
Right.
I mean, it isn't just abusive advisor. I mean, there's a spectrum where people can fall on that, but even reasonably benign advisors are cogs in an abusive system right. that is not set up to in any way, shape, or form prioritize you, your well, mental or physical health or well-being. It's exploitative. It's shaming.
Right. Well, it's like someone
it's based on overwork.
It's like someone on the podcast page said, uh-huh. it's the last feudal system. I don't know if it's the last. I don't know all the systems, but I know it's a feudal system.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it's going to be based on hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And in hierarchy, we have power. And most people do not know how to wield power without punishing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a system that is built on hierarchy and that is maintained by some level of punishing and inhumanity. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, that's really, I think you're right. I think mm-hmm. we step back to the whole system, and then we can never, ever, and I'm on a big kick about this lately. And this is, you know, it's embarrassingly late. I'm just going to say this. This is a sort of embarrassingly late to this idea. And I'm not late to it. I'm just expanding it. But this that we cannot separate any of these systems, any system that we're involved in anywhere, anytime, from the genesis of the country. So we can't separate it from genocide. We can't separate it from slavery. We can't separate it from that and how those are all part and parcel of capitalism. So we can't mm-hmm. separate it from capitalism, which mm-hmm. is on its face brutal. So mm-hmm. that's a good entry. You guys want to keep listening? Mm. We just made this like, wah, wah. But it's true. You cannot heal what you don't face. Mm-hmm. Just got to face some of this stuff. And so we're going
to
take that.
What did Biden say? To heal, we have to remember.
Right. I was mm-hmm. thinking more of Baldwin.
Mm-hmm. Because it was the day before yesterday. Yeah. It was the COVID memorial that he did the night before the inauguration.
Right. So anyway, all of that is the background to the idea of advisors. And I want to acknowledge, you know, and I'm not all advisors, but I do want to acknowledge that there are a lot of advisors who have really good intentions mm-hmm. and they really want to do a good job. Mm-hmm. And so part of what we're going to talk about today is the people who are trying to do a good job and are ending up doing the opposite because mm-hmm. of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But we're going to start with the much easier low-hanging fruit of the bad advisor. And there mm-hmm. are more of them than you would think.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, I work with a lot of people and I hear a lot of just gross stories, mm-hmm. just gross. Like, story just today. I was talking to somebody because I asked for people, like, tell me your advisor stories. And this person saying that they were late meeting a deadline for a publication or something that had to go back to the department and got a email back with the capital letters in the subject heading, "You will fail."
Are you serious?
And basically this thing about you're not going to succeed at this if you don't do X, Y, and Z. But the subject heading of the email was, "You will fail." The person after person after person who tells me their advisor says, you don't get any days off. You can't mm-hmm. take any days off. What are you talking about? No, you don't have days off.
I remember that is the origin of this episode. You right. came back and told me from some talk that you'd had and said, my advisor said I can't take any days off.
Right.
It's like, your advisor is not in a position to tell you that.
It's against the law.
Yeah, it's against the law. Yeah.
So let's just start down the list. So we made out a list of things that we asked around and people on the podcast page told us about where they saw abuse and
abuse.
Sorry, that was just stuttering over it. Where they saw abuse, and I put it into categories. And the first category that came up in a lot of different places was boundaries. Mm-hmm. And the boundaries were everything from sort of treating your graduate students like they're your friend, mm-hmm. Using your graduate students for service, mm-hmm. for services for you.
Mm-hmm. Especially when it's personal services like babysitting my kids.
Right, right. And I think about that, like when we were in Illinois, I know that we had graduate students who babysat the kids. And I look back on that now and think, well, I didn't really think about the fact. I just trusted that they were saying, sure, I don't even remember asking people to do mm-hmm. that, but people volunteering, but that may not be true.
Well, we also paid them, of course.
Right, you paid them, of course. But I also think that there's still that, like, do you feel like you have the right to say no mm-hmm. if somebody wields that much power mm-hmm. in your life? And so mm-hmm. I really think that we have to slice this really, really finely. And you may say, it's like, I think now that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. That was a mistake to say, you know, either they have offered or we said, are you free to babysit? Because I don't know if they felt, I don't know if it allowed for no in their mm-hmm. minds, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
So there's that. There's the really, like, sketchy stuff of, you know, can I pay you to babysit, or do you want a house sit, or any one mm-hmm. of those things that move the boundary between the work and the personal. Mm-hmm. So somebody I was talking to said that we got a message from said those little things make you end up feeling like you don't have a personal life,
mm-hmm.
because there's not a separation between the personal and the work.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that that there are much bigger boundary breaches than.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's the question of scholarly boundaries, mm-hmm. and whose ideas are whose, and who has the right to publish them, and who has ownership of data that's been generated, and, you know, places that are gray areas. In some lab settings, you know, it's a little bit more clearly laid out, but a lot of places are not clearly laid out, and mm-hmm. basically, you know, just not allowing your advisee to do their own work, have their own ideas, publish under their own name, move ahead, all of those things.
And consuming your advisee's work for your movement forward, mm-hmm. right? So you're going to, oh, wow, I have a graduate student. We're going to work together on this paper.
Mm-hmm.
The graduate student does a bunch of grunt work.
Mm-hmm.
You end up as first author.
Right.
And without the acknowledgement of the work that that graduate student put in, because right. you're thinking, well, this is my work and this is my stuff. And they just had to, you know, gather the data or do the analysis mm-hmm. or do the whatever. And I think those all get, I think they still remain fuzzy is that line of where are you helping people move forward in their career?
Mm-hmm.
And where are you consuming their effort for your career?
Right.
And it'd be really easy to tell yourself that you're doing it for you.
Absolutely.
For them.
Right. I know. So that's what makes it so hard. I guess that's part and parcel of what makes it so hard to identify abuse in the academy is that some of those lines are not at all clear.
Right. Anyway, so if we think about boundaries, so there's the boundaries between your work and your personal and the work. There's the boundaries between your works, you know, your graduate student's work and your work.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's all those, so that boundary between identity,
mm-hmm.
right? You know how many advisors are, because there's so much pressure to, you know, you're judged by your graduate students, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's really easy to have that boundary slip all over the place in terms of how you shape them right. So they're a good reflection
on you.
So
we're moving to the second, to a different thing on our list, which is molding.
Oh, yeah, and I guess it is. You're right. Yeah.
You know, the idea that the advisor is giving the message directly or indirectly that the only proper outcome of the PhD work is a tenure track position at an R1 institution. And that's preposterous at this point in time.
Oh, and I was thinking just in the more sort of hands-on idea of the only way to approach research is the way that I approach it.
Well, that too.
Right. So I'm going to mold you into being the reflection of my process, my thinking, my everything, without acknowledging that someone may work entirely
differently. Absolutely. Well, like my advisor was a, you know, empiricist social scientist, and I got, as I moved forward in my doctoral project, I realized that what I needed to do to pursue the questions that I was seeing were critical race theory, not to mention feminism, and she hated both of those things,
right?
Especially the former, and then she was basically like, "This isn't scholarship. This is outrageous. I thought you were a legitimate scholar, Karen.
Right.
What is this? This political nonsense?" And I was like, "I'm not in the wrong here."
Right. And I think that you remain. I mean, that your experience is unique in that you were very clear about what your banner was and what you were going to do, and you mm-hmm. were willing to suffer the slings and arrows to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the molding process of the academy from graduates or for undergraduate forward is that there are groups of people who are much more susceptible to the, I'm not doing it right. Oh, I must be fucking up. I've got mm-hmm. to figure out how to follow this model that my advisor keeps mm-hmm. laying on me.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I have for advisors is, are you curious about your advisee?
Mm-hmm.
Are you curious about them?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you approach their research with the curiosity you are insisting they approach your research with? are you curious about why they chose the method they did, or you just say, this is the method?
Mm-hmm.
Like, have you abandoned the entire Socratic idea of let's ask questions mm-hmm. to get to something to let's just, you just need to do it my way?
Mm-hmm.
And I see that over and over and over again of like, you have to do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't work that way and I don't want to do it. Well, you have to do it that way.
Right. It doesn't even make sense from a professional development perspective because PhD students who are just replicating what someone already did are not really the best PhD students, first of all.
Right. They're not. And they're not. And they don't have stuff on their. If your whole thing is, I want to be able to go on the academic job market, you're undermining them by not giving them something that mm-hmm. is on their own.
I mean, honestly, if I had done research on the model that my advisor wanted, it was terribly outdated
right.
by that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have done terribly on the job market if I had done what she wanted. But, you know, the larger issue is that even if it isn't outdated, even if it's absolutely current, that's that doesn't mean it's okay.
Right.
You still can't dominate your students.
Right.
You have to say, look, this is what I do. This is why I do it. This is how I do it. And this is why I think it will be valuable for your project.
Right.
Let me try to give you an example of why I think this is valuable for your project. But then that's as far as your lane goes. And then the student has to make their own choice.
And then I would think the next question would be, and what I hear you saying is that you'd like to use this. So taking
right.
what I just said and this, show me the cost-benefit analysis of
right.
these two things. Like, actually teach your students to analyze, think, and argue for their point
right.
rather than argue against authority mm-hmm. for their point. So they end up coming out of the PhD feeling like they're in a fight all the time.
That's a really good point.
Because
very deep.
Right. Like, what are you trying to, if you're trying to mold young minds, mm-hmm. then mold them into thinkers.
Right.
And I think if you get back to this idea of like, sort of, you must do it this way, or I don't get you, or this is the way that has to be done. I'm going to go back to this Trumpian 4 years of think of how you felt when you kept trying to say, but this is not the way I want to live. This is no. And what it felt like to have someone say, yeah, but sorry, this is America and this is the way we're doing it because I'm in charge. Mm-hmm. Remember that feeling mm-hmm. as you engage with your advisees. Mm-hmm. It feels like shit.
Mm-hmm. You know what? You showed me that thing on Twitter yesterday that put the juxtaposed Sean Spicer's very first press conference and Jen Psaki's very first press conference under Biden, and it's quite effective. It's really quite extraordinary. I urge you to Google this. I think it'll probably pop up and you can watch. It's about 1 minute long, right?
At the most.
And it just juxtaposes a few seconds of Spicer, a few seconds of Psaki, and how they started it, how they opened it, how they engaged with the reporters in the press conference, and then how they concluded it. And what was stunning was that Spicer came out fighting. He was pugilistic. He was abusive and bullying from the get-go. And I had forgotten him. I'd forgotten it. And I remember that when he came out, it was such a shock to all of us to see this behavior. It was so abusive, openly abusive. And everybody said Trump loved his performance because it was so belligerent. And that's what Trump wanted. And it got me thinking about the nature of the abusiveness under Trump was, and I love using the past tense, was bullying for bullying's sake. Yeah. Bullying because the bullying itself shows that you have the power to do it.
Right.
So the content of the bullying really mattered far less. And in fact, Spicer's a beautiful example of it. The size of his inauguration crowd.
Right.
It was patently false. Spicer knew it was false. The facts didn't matter. The point was, is I'm at the podium, you're not. I have control of the narrative, you don't, and I'm going to bully you and abuse you to deal with this falsehood, this false reality that I'm insisting on. And versus Jen Psaki, who was basically like, yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so here's what we know at the moment. Here's what we don't know. Here's what I can't answer for you. I don't know what the president is going to do. That's actually up to the president. Or the president doesn't really have a position right now on impeachment or a conviction of Trump in the Senate because that's actually a congressional question. So that's up to the Congress. And like everybody's boundaries were being respected.
Well, the other thing is too that I think that media scholars were talking about is that Psaki was basically saying there is a tension between this office and the press. It is a healthy and normal tension, and we will disagree. Mm-hmm. And we will come to disagreements, mm-hmm. but we will give you everything that we're willing to give you, mm-hmm. and we will do it with respect to the Fourth Estate.
So and in a respectful manner that doesn't undermine your humanity, we will simply say, because we have boundaries,
right.
we'll say, I can tell you X, but not Y. And yeah. that's not personal. That just is the way it is. And I think that academia could take a lesson from that. I'm going to...
I don't need to bully you.
I don't need to bully
but
you.
But see, I want to take that one step further to I think that so many advisors have lost track of the fact that their job is to engage and improve, that they're giving feedback to engage and improve to get you where you need to go. And I think a ton of people have taken their job as advisor as gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, I need to keep you out mm-hmm. if you're not up to this. Mm-hmm. But the up to this that they're defining is only through their own lens.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, you're not the right material. And so many people hear, you're not PhD material. You're never going to finish. And I will tell you that from the people I talk with, you can start to parse that out along race and gender lines,
oh,
right?
Sure.
And so the more intersections, the more you're not likely going to make it. Mm-hmm. So the gatekeeping comes down instead of, my job is to engage and counsel and show you how to do this so you can succeed at it or not.
Mm-hmm. This is all reminding me of a lifelong problem that I've had. I say lifelong, but I mean adult lifelong, certainly in the academy, because it's a personality issue, that when people send me something, I always... Without exception, my first response is, this is too short, or it's too long, or it's too wordy, or it's too emotional, or you didn't read what I wrote, you know, you didn't read the things I told you to read, and I immediately say everything that was wrong with it.
Right.
That's what I do. I'm not gatekeeping, actually. I don't have an investment. I'm casting my mind back, and I'm thinking about how I did this to my students. It was like, no, I fully believed in their ability to get into the academy. It's just that what I wanted to say, my first impulse was like, no, 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 this wasn't right, that wasn't right. Not like this means you're not qualified, but like, no, you just did all these things wrong. I consciously had to train myself, and I still do it to this day. I still write like that
yep.
in an email response. And then I go
talk
up
like that in a daily response.
yeah. And then I go up to the top and I say, thanks for getting this to me. I really appreciate all the work you did. I can see all the work you put into this, and I particularly can see the effort that you put into X, Y, and Z. I think it can be improved. Here's what I want you to focus on.
Right.
But that is never, from as far back as I can remember to this morning, it is never my first impulse.
Right.
And I think that personality type, first of all, gets drawn into the academy, that critical the hypercritical personality, and then it gets reinforced over right. and over and over again.
It gets given gold stars.
Yeah, gold stars for being like that.
Well, and it sort of gets to helps us slide into the other topic that we're talking about, which is like humanity.
Mm-hmm.
There is a failure to acknowledge the humanity of the person that you're dealing with. So that's like a on its face right up there, really, what's a good editor? And I talk about this all the time. I've been an editor for 30 plus years. I see academic feedback, and I'm calling it feedback because it's not constructive criticism. It's not editing. It's just whatever came out of your mouth. And that is, this is too long. That's not constructive feedback.
Right.
Right. So there's this whole thing of people who are not editors being in charge of editing. But there's also the other idea that you're forgetting that there is a human who has created something on the other side of it.
Exactly.
And you're forgetting there's a human who has created something, and creative people, it's their words, it's their ideas. So there's a vulnerability there. But you're also forgetting it's a human who created something who is dependent on your agreeing
right.
that it's... They're moving in the right direction.
Who's in a dependent relationship right. to you and a vulnerable relationship.
And they
to you.
quickly move into your approval is what I need to know I'm okay here.
Yeah.
And I'm working on a column right now on how to ask for effective feedback. So mm-hmm. You're not looking for approval, you're looking to improve.
Mm-hmm.
But I think right there, if you are an advisor what is the goal of what you're saying to the person you're saying it to? So if they send you something and your response is, this is absolutely, and again, I had another client telling me about this just recently. This is so bad, it's not even worth my reading. Like, fuck you and fuck you again. Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So if it is that bad and you want to be a good advisor, then it's, hey, come in because we're going to need to go through. Let's just go through a page and let me show you where you're off the mark. Mm-hmm. Right? Or if you're like, I've done this 5 times with this person, mm-hmm. then you just have 5 questions. You know, what's the argument you're trying to make? What's your evidence? Who's your audience? Something that's your standard. Mm-hmm. But tell me how it helps to say, this is so bad that I'm mm-hmm. not going to read it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cruel.
It is, yeah. And I mean, in the end, after having gone through a certain process with the student, that it is within the advisor's rights to say, I have worked with you now on whatever, this dissertation for a year or whatever, this chapter for whatever. And I feel I have not seen you progress.
Yeah.
I am not seeing adequate progress.
Yep.
And again, this is a gray area,
right?
Because it might be that this is a woman of color who no amount of excellence is going to read as excellence to you.
Right.
You're going to always.
You're an old white guy who's like.
And you're going to, you can't see it because you're racist and by racist, I don't mean consciously racist. I mean that you are embedded in white supremacy and you just can't see black excellence, for example. So there are many, many layers to this. But the fact is that it is within the advisor's right that we're not saying accept everything. We're not saying don't have boundaries. We're saying have boundaries, healthy boundaries. You know, good fences make good neighbors. Healthy boundaries make good advising relationships.
Yes.
Sometimes the outcome of that boundary is, and those standards are, that you say, I actually can't, I'm not willing to work with you any longer.
Right.
I don't feel you're making adequate progress. I'm going to urge you to consider doing something else with your life. Now, the advisee hearing that may experience that as abusive, and it isn't.
Right.
If it's delivered from the right place, which it's very rarely is.
Well, and it's delivered after consistent feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons that I think, I know in the UK PhD program, or maybe it's not the UK, maybe it's particular universities, as you're meeting with your advisee, you actually have to fill out a form that mm-hmm. says, this is what we discussed, these are the next goals, this is this. I think that's a tremendously valuable thing to do with any advisee, because I think it shows tremendous respect that you paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
Advisees, I think that you could do the same exact thing. You could write after a meeting with your advisor and say, these are the things I understood that you would like me to do next. So it's in writing, mm-hmm. and not because you want to be all litigious about it, but so you're on the same page together.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody can say, oh my goodness, that is not what I meant.
Well, it's also self-protective of the advisee, because they, you know, that prevents that whiplash, well, the unpredictability,
right.
Inconsistencies of advisors who say, you know, you don't have enough feminist theory, you have to put in 20 pages of feminist theory, so you do it, and then give them the next draft, and they're like, what is all this feminist theory? This is
exactly.
ridiculous. Don't make me read this. Doesn't apply at all. And so
you're just but you told me to put a feminist theory.
If you have a written record, you can have the memo following on the previous meeting and say, you know, you did tell me to do that.
Well, which gets to another sort of interesting area that I heard back from some people that they found incredibly discouraging. So advisees that said that they found this incredibly discouraging in their PhD to have advisors who are over invested in the perfection of their project.
Mm-hmm.
So every single time they submit something, they get just huge amounts of feedback,
mm-hmm.
what they perceive of as excessive feedback,
mm-hmm.
without ever acknowledging movement forward,
mm-hmm.
right? So here I have this thing, and I'm just going to take the feminist theory thing, right? So here's this piece. Look, you really need more feminist theory tying this to this. Great. So you do all this work, feminist theory. And then they say, okay, now you have this and you did this. So you think you're progressing, and then they're giving you another huge
mm-hmm.
amount on the same section
mm-hmm.
that just stays on, I'm going to keep coming back to this chapter and keep coming back to this chapter, because the advisors have forgotten that the PhD or the dissertation or thesis is not supposed to be a perfect document.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be a training ground.
Right.
So,
and there's also it is an art.
Right.
It's very delicate because it's a balance, because the advisor has to let some stuff slide.
Yeah.
You have to, because otherwise you could perseverate obsessively on one chapter of the dissertation forever. Right. And that just, so, you know, some things have to, like, okay, so they managed, you know, 4 out of the 5 things I asked reasonably improved. So now let's move on to the next chapter. Okay, now that the entire dissertation is done, I want to revisit that issue I had with chapter 2, because in truth, I don't think you've yet really adequately addressed the blah, blah, blah. But,
right.
you know, so in other words, it's kind of that managing human motivations
acknowledging people's humanity.
Right, in a sensitive way. Right. So that, you know, yeah, basically so that the advisee can feel a sense of forward progress and achievement and accomplishment and still be given a chance at different points in a chronological path to go back and improve things.
Right, and I think that the advisors could do themselves a really good service by asking, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I having them do this? Because if you don't have a pedagogy behind what you're doing, if you don't have an intention behind what you're doing, mm-hmm. I'm trying to, and in a dissertation, my assumption would be as an editor, I'm trying to move this toward completion mm-hmm. all the time. If it's become, I'm trying to make this towards perfection, or I'm trying to move this toward what I would do, mm-hmm. then we're out of our lanes, right?
So I just want to pause and say, yes, I want to put a pin in, I'm not put it, I want to emphasize that. The goal is completion, not perfection.
Right.
Goal is completion, not perfection.
Right.
And advisors.
Right.
And also advisees.
And advisees. I mean, did they get it? Like, did they get it? You know the theory. Did they get it? Did they argue it well? Did they put it together well? Yeah, that middle section of that chapter, it gets a little mucky right there. But did you get it? Okay, let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you can go back for edits later, but let's move on mm-hmm. and make sure that that's still happening. Because I will tell you, advisors, your advisees are harmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
They keep bringing you, think about creative work. Mm-hmm. And if any of you do any kind of creative work, you cook, you bake, you sew, you paint, you knit, mm-hmm. and you bring that piece of creative work to another person and you say, here's my dinner I made, or here's my sweater I knit for you, or here's this. There's a vulnerability there that is incredibly intense. And I think writers are no different.
Mm-hmm.
You're making something out of nothing.
That's one of your insights, is academia is creative work.
Right.
Academic work is creative work, and we are not in the habit of thinking that.
And academic work is incredibly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we flip over into these like New York Times art critics, like, well, looking at the light, it's like, I'm not Van Gogh. I'm at the beginning part
right.
of my painting career. Could
right.
we look at it that way?
Right.
So if you're judging your advisees' dissertations as the next great master's work, well, this is not yet David. Well, duh. I've just figured out how to use a chisel. Does it look like a human? Are we ready to admit I made a human? The feet are in proportion.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So check your intention, advisors, because your lack of intention or self-awareness of your intention is causing harm.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely true.
And then as long as we're talking about the humanity issue, I mean, there's also the basic work-life balance issue. So this is setting aside the scholarly project, which is a place of great ambiguity.
Right.
What is good enough?
Right.
These are judgment calls, absolutely. So it's not easy, but kindness is never, and remember, I'm not saying nice. I'm not being nice and sugarcoat things, but kindness is never wrong. But far less, you know, ambiguous is basic humanity about work-life balance.
Oh,
I mean, we should not be investing in and imposing regimes of overwork and exploitation. We just shouldn't be. And advisors, if you know, telling like the story that you told, oh, well, I guess we already alluded to it, but you're not allowed to take any days
right.
off. I mean, that's illegal and it's inappropriate, it's outrageous, and it's dumb. people who don't take days off are people who are not doing their best work. No, everybody totally needs rest to do good work.
Right. And just because this is a little bit like the whole ER doc model or the medical school model, right? Uh-huh. So I stayed up for 36, you know, days in a row, not days, but you know what I'm saying? I had a 3-day shift and I survived it. And you need to learn how to buck up. No, how about that was inhumane and made you not a good doctor?
And also, if you're doing French literature, honestly, you don't need to do it.
Right.
I mean, I don't know enough about medical school to know, but I know there are things and surgeries and crises, and sometimes you have to go a long time without sleeping. But if you're writing a dissertation in the humanities, no, there's nothing that...
Well, and I'm going to just take it over to the most... Okay, so if you're the person working on the cutting edge of some science that's going to save a bunch of people, it's really easy to move out of work-life balance there too and just stop. Because you're going to be more effective when you rest. Mm-hmm. But if you have decided that you are going to work a 70-hour week, that's your own toxic behavior. A 40-hour week is a reasonable week. Mm-hmm. Weekends off. Start from the minute you start working with your advisees. Take weekends off. Maintain your hobbies. Maintain your friendships. Do not give this corporation that will take everything you give it any more than what you're paid for.
And, the
and just because
is,
you decided to do it, don't visit it on them.
Yeah. I mean, I think the trouble is the people who... It's self-selecting.
Right.
So the advisors who demand this already do it.
Right.
themselves.
Right.
And so they demand it of others because they have no boundaries, because they because they're invested in the toxicity of it all. And so and the advisors who don't, the advisors who have good work-life balance are going to be the ones who encourage that in their advisees. So it's almost like I feel a certain sense of futility in even saying what we're saying, because the advisors who are the toxic ones are not listening to us and are not
well,
going
I'm
to
hoping,
acknowledge
I'm
the
hoping,
problem that the problem exists.
I'm hoping that out there right now is somebody who said last week to their advisee, "You have to devote 60 hours a week or you'll never make it." And I hope that you hear me say, that's a fucking lie.
And also stuff that's a little bit less obvious than that. Even stuff that sounds better than that. Like, why did you not get me that draft?
Right.
Well, how about we're in a pandemic. Your advisee has two small children who are stuck at home because there's no daycare. We had an insurrection at the Capitol. I mean, how about a few, you know, how about some of that?
Right.
Like, so in other words, there isn't something overtly wrong on its face with why didn't you get me that draft, except if you step back and look at the circumstances, then there is.
Right. If you're willing to see a person as an individual, and I think that that's really hard. I'm going to just be, I think it's really hard because that if we do that, if we step back and we look at this advising and think, wow, I wonder how they're doing. By default, we have to wonder about how we're doing.
Yeah.
And if we have to wonder about how we're doing, then the whole thing that we built might start to crumble. So we're sticking our fingers in our ears going, I'm fine and you will be fine.
Because you have to be fine because I can't deal with you.
Not being fine.
Not being fine.
Right? So I think that there's a whole bunch that comes unstuck. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean unstuck in a productive way like my writing program, but like literally starts to, it's kind of like all the pieces start coming off the spinning system when somebody says, hey, maybe this isn't a good idea.
You know, that's so much like a parent-child relationship where the parent is like, you have to be fine because if you're not fine,
right,
then you make me have to confront that I'm not fine. So everybody in this family, God damn it, has to be fine.
Right. Right. You and it's because
I know we both grew up in versions of that.
Right. Like be fine.
Be fine.
And if you're
it's
not
all
fine,
fine,
and it's you're the problem.
You're the problem. If you're not fine, you're the problem. Right. Not
right. So I really, you know, in the sort of last of those, I mean, in the really concrete things, when your advisee is sick, do you tell them don't come to work or don't work? Why are you working? Mm-hmm. Do you come back? Do when they come back from work, do you say, well, we need to double up because you're behind? You're not behind. You took time off and your schedule has now changed, right? Do you expect your advisee, do you email your advisee on weekends? Do you text your advisee? Do not text your advisee. Don't, unless you're paying for that person's phone, keep your business self off their phone. Stop it. Don't email outside of office hours because it tells the advisee I'm supposed to answer outside of office hours. There's a message sent there. So if you need to tell them something, set it to schedule to go at 9 o'clock on Monday morning or at 8 o'clock the next morning. But just because you're up at 2 a.m. trying to figure out why this molecule does this, don't send it off to your advisee.
Right.
Give them the message from the very beginning, contain your work so it doesn't consume you. Yeah.
And then acknowledge the reality of bodies, that we live in bodies. Bodies get sick, bodies get pregnant, bodies breastfeed, bodies suffer mental illness and
bodies
stress.
Bodies study chronic health. We're going to see a lot of people with some chronic health stuff from all this stress. And if we want to have a fully diverse university system, then we need to adapt to allow those bodies to exist in that system. And we haven't right now. Mm-hmm. So.
And that's not even really getting into the issues of neurodiversity and disabilities and, you know, things of that nature.
Right. And then the last thing, I mean, this is, maybe we'll pick this up some other time, but we also did want to say, and this is not an intentional abusive behavior, and it's not even, I don't know if we even want to put it in the category of abuse, it's just a little bit harmful, is that we have faculty who are overwhelmed and they're over their heads.
The majority, really.
Right. And they don't have the time that they had, and they're just really struggling. Mm-hmm. And so we leave advisees out in the cold. They send us a chapter and we're too overwhelmed and we don't get it to them. They say they're going to do something and we don't respond. And I hear from a lot of people, I haven't heard from my advisor for 2 months. I haven't heard for 3 months. And I think, again, we're back to gray area, right? Mm-hmm. You need to be honest with your advisee. I will get that to you as soon as I can. And that may be 2 months. Mm-hmm. Or you need to say, be honest with yourself and say, I do not want a whole chapter, man. Just give me the page because I don't have the time for it. Without visiting upon your advisee, your emotional and personal or professional stress. And it's a fine line.
So that is a fine line because, I mean, if you, you know, and I guess that in a sense, this is the teaching of shame and vulnerability as the antidote to shame. Right. That Brené Brown has talked about so much that's been so transformative, which is it's okay to say you're overwhelmed.
Yeah.
If in the absence of saying you're overwhelmed, what you will probably do is enact your overwhelm, impose your overwhelm onto the student, either by disappearing, by ghosting them, or by getting hyper-controlling or hyper-emotional or, you know, all sorts of sort of less effective behaviors, maybe even toxic behaviors. And the antidote to all of that is to say, I'm really overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed because my kids are home. I'm overwhelmed because I'm frightened of the pandemic. I'm overwhelmed because of 100 other things that are going on. I'm not my best self. I'm very short-tempered. You know, please forgive me if I am short with you and let me know. Like, because I might, and I want to hear from you if I've crossed a line, because I'm worried about that. And also maybe if you don't hear from me in 5 days, please, please text me. Here's my number. Text me
and
ask
said, don't
me.
Text.
I know you did say that. I'm not as, I don't know about any, well, whatever. I don't want to get into that, like that question, but then email me, follow up, make sure come and, you know, just get, you know, send up whatever messages, because I want to do right by you. It's just that I'm struggling to do right by anybody right now.
And what I would say is all of that stuff that you just said, I'm overwhelmed, my kids, my this, that's none of their business. The last part is their business. Mm-hmm. I have limited concentration right now, and I want to make sure that you get part of that concentration. This is the way it will happen.
Mm-hmm.
So all that other stuff is internal work that I think is laying your emotional life on your advisee and is a boundary issue where we're not having intimate conversations with our advisees. Mm-hmm. We're not having friendships. We're not doing that, but we are having internal dialogues that say, that, again, I think is Brown stuff of I'm going to get out from under my shame of this and admit I'm overwhelmed.
Right.
I'm not going to run from that.
Right. And remember, capitalism wants us overwhelmed.
Absolutely.
I mean, capitalism, especially with these conditions, is exploitation. I want to say something, though. I hear you on that. I also want to say that there's a feminist praxis that's possible where, you know, an advisor, especially like a woman, who can actually say, you know, these are the challenges of having kids as an academic, and you know, to and to allow that to be visible and seen.
Yep.
That's a pretty important intervention to make in the training apparatus. And I know that grad students often really, really appreciate that, like that reality. So I hear you. Again, we're getting it again in this like gray area judgment call. But how much is too much?
What's your intention?
Mm-hmm.
Right. If what your intention is that I'm going to be honest about the pulls on my system, on the things and what that is. There's a very different thing to say to a graduate student. Look, you know, there are 15 different things pulling on my attention right now, and this is the reality of being a woman in the academy. Is that that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make sure that you stay in the top five of those. Mm-hmm. It is very different than this sort of emotional and I hate to say emotional because I think it starts to sound sort of anti-female, and that's not really what I mean, because then I think if we attach female to emotions, whatever, now we're spiraling. I am. So I just think it's really interesting to like, are you trying to lay your emotions in their lap, or are you trying to tell the truth in a way that they can see the system? And I think it's gray.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. You're not their friend.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bottom line. To talking to somebody as if they are your friend, even if they come to you and lay all that your direction, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different power dynamic that somebody comes in tears and says, I'm overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
My kids are home. I can't do this. That is not a breach of a power dynamic for someone junior to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And what we don't want to fall into is then now I'm going to do that with you.
Right.
We just don't.
Yep.
So anyway.
I agree.
All right. I think we made it through our list. Watch your boundaries. Oh, we didn't talk about taking credit. One of the places that we see abuse is that people, we talked about people doing all the work and taking credit. We talked about molding. We talked about paying attention to people's humanity and not treating them inhumanely, and then visiting your emotional state on your advisees or not acknowledging that you are in it and it's affecting the information that they're going to give. Mm-hmm. So be honest about it up front. Mm-hmm. So
you know, we jump back and forth from we're talking to advisors, talking to advisees, trying to balance both of those perspectives. And basically, you know, the gist being advisors, please don't do this toxic behavior. But advisees, I hope, you know, our goal really is if you see your advisor doing this, please, please, you know, really consider, you know, really give thought to that you, what we want to do is empower you not to feel that you did something wrong.
Right. It's not about you.
It's not about you.
Yeah,
and if your advisor is doing these things, first of all, identify them accurately. Wow, that's inappropriate. Wow, maybe just inappropriate. Maybe that's actually, whoa, that's actually abusive. Whoa, that's actually toxic. Whoa, that's actually dangerous to my well-being. I need to get a different advisor. I need to make different choices. This is a spectrum. It's a continuum. Not all of them, not everything's a crisis, but we really want to empower you to as a first step, correctly identify what you're dealing with.
Right. And that for a lot of you, a lot of pain can be eliminated by not expecting your advisor to not looking to your advisor for proof that you belong, but looking to your advisor for feedback on how to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And even their feedback is not an indicator of your belonging. It's just their feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about in the next episode or so about this idea of belonging versus improving.
Mm-hmm.
So.